Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Podcast with Bunsen Burner. This is episode 4 of season 1. My name is Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher and the dog dad of Bunsen. Or to be more accurate, I'm Bunsen's human. You can follow Bunsen's science adventures on social media. He's on Twitter, Bunsen Burner BMD, Facebook and Instagram, BunsenBurner.BMD. He's also on TikTok with that same handle. We have an adorable merchandise shop. If you want to know more about that, click on the link in the description to the podcast. The podcast will also always be free, but we've set up a Patreon account to cover some of the costs to run the podcast. If you really enjoy the podcast, consider signing up at the Patreon. It's Patreon/Bunsen Burner. There's 3 different tiers that you can sign up at, and there's some really cool swag depending on which one you sign up for. We have an amazing show coming up for you. We have news about space in today's show, we're wow about space, and we're interviewing a space expert. So we might as well just get right to it, because there's no time like science time. The theme for this week is space, so we're going to be doing some space news. And the news is about the Japanese spacecraft Hayabusa 2. And how it's grabbing some dust from an asteroid that could be billions of years old. So, the story goes like this. Way back in February, the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft made its first landing on the asteroid. And the asteroid's called Ryugu, but it's spelt R-Y-U-G-U. And Ryugu is maybe how you could say it, but in listening to the Japanese people speak it, they pronounce it Ryugu or Ryugu, so like Ryugu, just a little bit quickly there. So that's how I'm going to pronounce it, Ryugu. Anyways, back in February, it touched down on this asteroid, and it blasted a bullet at the surface to kick up dust and to make sure that the software and its structure could capture the dust properly. And it worked. So it captured some of the dust, and it's like it's got this dust-collecting horn. So it basically shot the asteroid to get some dust. Then it took off again, so it could land and take off. So it took off again, found a proper place around the asteroid, and in April, it dropped like a copper weight onto the surface from about 0.5 kilometers above, and it made an artificial crater. So it literally bombed the asteroid so that would kick up dust on the surface from deep inside the asteroid that hasn't seen any sunlight for, you know, billions of years. So it's like really ancient dust. The science news is that on July 10th, it made its final approach to land and grab the dust. They were very worried about the second touchdown because it's a rocky surface. And if it fails, then the spacecraft can't make it back to Earth so they can look at the dust it's collected. But later that day, mission control received confirmation that the spacecraft was safe. So now they just have to wait for this spacecraft to fly back to Earth, and then who knows what mysteries would be found in billion-year-old dust. Maybe some billion-year-old dust bunnies. I know, Bunsen, it wasn't a good joke. Anyways, that's the science news for this week. This part of the show is called I'll be giving you 3 statements this week about space. 2 of them are myths or false, they're woo. And 1 of them is true. It's a fact that will make you go, wow! Here's statement 1. When you call somebody on your cellular phone, most likely the phone call has to go to space and bounce off a satellite and triangulate the person that you are calling. Here's the second statement. In direct sunlight, outside of a spacecraft, it is incredibly hot. Here's the third statement. A spaceship flying through the asteroid belt, which lies between Mars and Jupiter's orbit around the sun, would be incredibly dangerous. Think the scene from Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where Peter Quill and Rocket are fighting over who should fly a spaceship through the asteroid belt. Or maybe even Star Wars when Han Solo says, "Never tell me the odds." Okay, those are your 3 statements. Let's recap them. Statement 1, when you call somebody, most likely your phone call goes to space, to a satellite. Statement 2, when you're in direct sunlight outside of a spacecraft, it's incredibly hot. And statement 3, flying through an asteroid belt in space would be pretty dangerous. okay, there's only one true statement. Which one is it? Time's up. Okay, the first fake statement is the asteroid belt one. So within our solar system, we use this unit of measurement called an AU, or an astronomical unit. From the sun to the Earth is one astronomical unit. The asteroid belt is 2.2 to 3.2 astronomical units away from the sun. That's around 300 million to 500 million kilometers. And for the Americans out there, that's 200 to 300 million miles. So the asteroids are like hecka far away from the sun. But can you fly through them safely? And the answer is absolutely. The asteroids are crazy spread out. The average distance between asteroids is just shy of 1 million kilometers. Now, 1 million kilometers on Earth, the difference between 1 million kilometers, you could easily fly a spaceship through that thousands, millions, hundreds of millions of times blindfolded and never hit an asteroid that's 1 million kilometers apart. It's far more exciting in movies to show the asteroids bonking into each other and a daring pilot having to zip between imminent death. That's not the way it is in our solar system. So that one's woo. That leaves us only two statements left, and one of them is fake, one of them is woo, one of them is true. It's a wow. So which one is woo that's left? It is the cellular device sending to outer space signal one. That is not true. And that's kind of funny because I always bug my high school kids when they're texting each other outside. I'm like, when you're texting each other a cat picture, and that cat picture is going up to outer space, finding a satellite, and beaming down the cat picture to your friend who's literally standing right next to you. That is not a good use of our technology that people put into outer space. And that's a bunch of hooey. Usually when you call somebody, unless you're making an international call, like if you're calling somebody across a city or even within your country, I'd have to check with Canada because Canada is super big. But if you're calling somebody nearby, even within, you know, 100, 200 kilometers, you're using cell phone towers and underground cables. So your signal is finding a tower, finding another tower, and then using underground cables in some cases. So that was something that I didn't know till a couple months ago, and I had been making fun of kids for a while. Now, I'm not going to say I regret making fun of my students, because most of the time, they deserve it. So, but spreading misinformation is something that I probably shouldn't have been doing, and now you know, and I know, it's woo. That leaves the true statement being that in outer space, in direct sunlight, it is hecka hot. It is very, very hot. 250 degrees Fahrenheit or 121 degrees Celsius. That's boiling. So if you got roundhouse kicked out an airlock without any, you know, protection, the side of you that's facing the sun would start to boil because it's so hot. And the side of you that wasn't facing the sun would be incredibly cold, like dry ice cold, liquid nitrogen cold. So one side of you would boil and one side of you would freeze. So you'd get freezer burnt and you'd get burnt. Burnt freezer burnt. Chris Hadfield, a Canadian astronaut. Man, we love Chris Hadfield. He's like a super cool guy. You might, if you don't know who Chris Hadfield is and you're not Canadian, he's like a Canadian hero. He's got like this awesome mustache. And he brought a guitar up to the ISS and he sang a song, a David Bowie song. And he's just an icon in Canada. Anyways, we don't have too many Canadian astronauts. Okay, I digress. But anyways, he explained this, that it's a common misconception that when you get kicked out an airlock, you would just like freeze solid, but you wouldn't. You'd have one side that would get really, really hot and you'd have one side that would get really, really cold.
Jason, would you be Harvey Dented?
What? Okay, anyway, so that's Space Edition.
We're pretty excited on the Ask an Expert section of the podcast to have somebody who knows all about the cosmos. She's a star and knows lots about stellar objects. So we might as well just get right to it and talk to Serafina Nance. We are so excited to have on the Science Podcast Serafina Nance. She's a PhD student in astrophysics, or astronomy. How are you doing, Sarah?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so honored.
We know you from Twitter. You've got a really high profile on Twitter. You're tweeting all the time about amazing space facts. And you have a dog named Comet, and we'll talk about Comet later. So you're the perfect person for the science podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm excited.
You're in San Francisco, is that correct?
I am in Berkeley, yeah, right outside of San Francisco.
Right. Okay, so I've only been to San Francisco twice in my life. Berkeley is, like, how far out of San Francisco is Berkeley?
So it's like, honestly, without traffic, probably like 20 minutes. But with traffic, it can be like an hour and a half.
Oh my goodness.
So it really depends.
Is there public transit to get out there, or is it just a nightmare no matter what?
So there's BART, which is actually like super helpful, but of course there's a ton of traffic on BART as well. So it's like, it's a trek to get into the city, but like, it's not that bad. You know, if you budget the time for it, it's totally doable.
Gotcha. Yeah. Much different in where I live. We have rush minute. It's called like at 6:01 and 5:01 PM. It gets pretty busy. Yeah. You might have to wait a couple times at a traffic light. So yeah, you betcha. Could you tell everybody a little bit about what your background in science, like where are you in your journey and how would you describe what you have right now to people who don't have any idea what it takes to get into astrophysics or astronomy?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am currently a grad student in astronomy or astrophysics, however you want to say it, at UC Berkeley. And I just passed in December, my master's exam. So I am now officially a PhD student, which I'm super stoked about. So I started, being interested in astronomy when I was like 4 years old. I remember wanting to stargaze with my dad all the time. Mm-hmm. And I would always ask him questions about space. And that kind of just continued, until middle school. I went to a science camp and I was super cool. So I was like, I want to go to science camp. And they had an astronomer come out and like bring out a telescope and we got to look at the moon. And I told him like flat out, I was like, you know, Mr. whatever his name was, I want to be an astronomer. And I distinctly remember he looked at me and he was like, you don't want to do this. Like, this is not for you.
Oh.
And I know. And I was like, it was like summer of fifth grade. And I like, you know, how does a fifth grader handle that? I just kind of was like, but I like stars. And I was very lucky in that I had other mentors, like my parents, and like teachers at school who didn't, let me kind of buy into that and just kept supporting me. So I switched schools that next year and I went to a school that had an astronomy class, in high school. So it was a middle school and high school. And I was like, I want to take that class. And the like dean was like, okay, you need to wait until you are in 11th grade. And so I was like, fine, I guess. And so I just kind of bid my time and, you know, read about space as much as I could in my spare time. And then I took that class in 11th grade and I absolutely loved it. And one of the best things about it was that it was very much like about how exciting space was and the historical context of like discoveries in, you know, astronomy and physics. And it was much less about like memorizing equations and deriving things. Mm-hmm. So it kept students engaged, which I thought was really awesome. So it was like all of the really like sort of hot topics, like multiverses and dark energy and stuff like that was very much like a discussion rather than can you, you know, like solve this problem. And so that really prompted me to say, okay, this is definitely what I want to do. And I decided to ask that professor to do an independent study with me my senior year, where I said, I want to learn about dark energy. Can we just meet, you know, once a week and talk about it, and I'll choose the books that I have to read as long as you approve them. And basically I'll come to you with questions and we'll just discuss. And he said, yes. And I was very happy. And so
that's awesome.
I basically got to, it was a really awesome opportunity. Because I basically got to design my own class for like what I wanted to learn about, which was amazing. And I met with him once a week, and I probably like didn't understand that much, which was fine. It was a lot of like hard topics. But it was exciting and it was cool. And he actually introduced me to a professor at the University of Texas, and that's because I lived in Austin. So he was like, hey, I taught this professor's kids. Why don't you go meet with him for an afternoon? And so my mom like drove me because I didn't know how to drive yet.
It's okay.
She dropped me off and I met with him for like 3 hours, and I just asked him questions, and he ended up being my college advisor. So I went to the University of Texas, and I double majored in physics and in astronomy. And he ended up being my advisor my entire time. And I had an amazing, he was like the best advisor I could ever ask for. And then I went to grad school. I took a year off between, and then I went to grad school.
Very good. So you, it sounds like you knew early, and every time you took anything academic about space, it just kind of like solidified your drive to, you know, get a career in the cosmos.
Yeah. Exactly. And it was interesting because math was never something that I felt was easy for me. I worked really hard and I always felt I was really bad at math. And everyone told me, well, you have to do math, you know, if you're going to do science. And it took me a long time to grow my confidence in math and like feel like I could do it. And now it's one of my like favorite things about science, but it was definitely like, that was the hard part for me. It wasn't the interest. It was just kind of the nuts and bolts of like, how do you solve a physics problem? That sort of thing.
Well, that's some pretty good perseverance.
Thank you.
Yeah. Math is tough for a lot of kids too. Like I teach high school chemistry. And the math and chemistry is not anywhere near the level of difficulty as the math and physics.
Right.
But
still.
It's still math. That's the main message. That's the main message. 100%. Yeah. Everybody's not good at everything, but you can make yourself better through practice and trying.
Exactly. And if you have an interest in something, like, I think just keep trying, you know? At least that's my 2 cents.
That's great. So in your field, man, space is just... Space is one of the coolest things. Just as an aside, in my classes, when I talk about space, it's sometimes the first time kids have ever really thought about space. And these are kids like in our Canadian system, which are in grade 9 or 10, and their minds are just blown. Just simple things about space. And you know, like, so much more about space than the average person. And along that, what do you think is the best part about your field? Like, what do you like best about space? If you could distill it down to, you know, a couple ideas.
So I think instead of choosing like a specific thing in terms of like supernova or galaxies or something like that, I think the thing that is most interesting to me about space and what got me interested when I was a little kid is the big picture of that sort of wonder about the universe and trying to understand and think about and learn how to consider how we got here. Are we alone? How big is the universe?
Oh, man.
What is the fate of the universe? That sort of thing.
So just the scale and the scope of it, hey?
Yeah, I think the perspective that it offers and the fundamental insight that it brings to humans and, you know, our interactions with each other and our place on Earth is really profound. And I think a lot of different types of science, you know, whether it's at the molecular scale or whether it's at the universal scale, do that. But that's really what drew me in for spaces, is being able to understand our place in the universe and trying to think about what that is, and then also trying to understand how to draw meaning from that, how that impacts how you think about life and how you go about your day-to-day experiences. That's really the thing that I like best, I think.
Oh, that's such a deep answer. I love that.
That's so cool. Thanks, I try.
That's so cool. Now, as you have learned more about space and all of the crazy math that you've had to go through, has space gotten even bigger, or has space narrowed for you? Like, is it the thing that more you know, the less you know, or has space become?
Yes.
Is that what's happening? Oh, I figured you were going to say that. That's very cool.
No, that's a good question. Yeah, I think especially as you like kind of go through a PhD program, the more you learn, the more you realize, like, oh God, I have so much more to learn. And that's a really freeing feeling.
That's cool. Especially if you're curious, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, since this is the podcast, can we talk a little bit about your dog, Comet? Is that okay?
I would love to talk about Comet.
I love your dog, Comet. He's adorable. Do you have a Comet story for us that you could share?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a lot of really small stories. Like the other day, he fell asleep on the couch and then he woke himself up because he fell off the couch, which was absolutely yes. But I think my most memorable story of him is our first like big adventure together. So I like to backpack a lot, and he came with me to the Cascades in Washington, and we were winter camping for, I guess, 3 days, 2 days. And we were just kind of literally in the middle of nowhere. My dog is from Texas. He was like, what is snow?
That's awesome.
And yeah, he lost his mind. I was like, he's either going to be terrified of the snow or he's going to love it. And he ended up just like frolicking all the time. He slept in my sleeping bag with me. And that was great. And he ended up like leading us basically back to our car. So like we had been gone for 2 days, and then he knew the trail and was able to like take us back to the car on our way back, and was just like a little wolf pack animal. It was amazing. Yeah, I think that was the big one because it was our first one, but any outdoors backpacking experience with him is just wonderful.
That's adorable. Yeah, he looks like he's pretty attached to you, and he's a pretty affectionate dog. So that's
he is. his favorite thing to do is lick people's faces. So he's now gotten to the point where he can like lick inside of your nose.
Oh.
It's he doesn't know any personal boundaries.
Yeah, dogs can be like that. Hey, that's awesome. Back to science a bit. We talked a little bit before, maybe, or you did, about some of the obstacles that you had to get through, the math obstacle. One of the things I've really noticed on Twitter is just how there's a lot of younger women in science that are, you know, putting themselves out there and educating the public through SciComm, like science communication, and mm-hmm. and I think that's such a positive role model for kids in school who might be following people to see themselves in science and know that it's possible. One of the questions I have is there any other types of resistance or obstacles that you had to get through that you could give a little bit of advice to people pursuing a career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the two big things that I struggled with, and they're all related, but I think one of them we spoke about briefly was my struggle with math. And that really fed into imposter syndrome. So for those that are not familiar with that, that's basically feeling like you don't belong and that you kind of cheated the system to be able to get to where you are. And that's something I still struggle with. That's, I think, almost every scientist I know struggles with it. But I see it especially in underrepresented minorities in science and people, marginalized communities that have had to have so many other sort of hurdles that they have to surmount and face. And that's really tough. And I think that is combined with, for me, being a woman of color in my field, I didn't have any professors that were women. I had one woman of color professor my entire physics career. And that is pretty isolating, and it's hard when you do have sort of the old white male professor kind of, some of them are great, but there are others that aren't. And I sat in a class with a professor who would make lewd jokes and would tell basically the class to their face that, you know, women don't really have a place in science or in math. And that's tough.
That's disappointing. I'm so sorry to hear that. That's super frustrating.
Yeah. It's incredibly frustrating. It is. And I think as a young scientist, like even when I was in high school or in college, I didn't really realize how damaging that was. I didn't know because that was the norm, right? Like I didn't have any perspective of saying like, hang on, this is not okay. I should not be subjected to this. Nobody should be subjected to this. And so it's really taken a lot of maturing and actually finding the community on Twitter of other women scientists, learning from them, learning from their experiences, and being able to really vocalize, hang on, this was not okay. And I don't think that anybody else should have to go through that. So I think my advice or, you know, ways that I guess, kind of pushed through that is finding a community of people. That's really a huge one. So in college, I was in a sorority. That was really helpful. But I also had an amazing advisor. I had my parents. And as I've grown older, right, I have this community on Twitter. For the first time, I'm interacting with women scientists, women of color, all the time. And that is just a stark contrast to what I had in college and what I grew up with. And so that solidarity and that community really offers a place to learn and to grow my own confidence in myself and in my science and just in as being a woman and as being a woman of color. So that's huge. And the other thing I think is that the big thing that I fell back on when I was in college, I remember after my first semester of taking physics, I was like, why am I doing this? This is so hard. I'm not good at it. The math is really hard. And one of the hard parts about physics is it's very difficult to teach. It's a lot of self-teaching. And it was my first time really being exposed to that. And I told my dad, you know, Dad, I don't know if this is the right fit for me. I love astronomy, but I hate physics. And he said, okay, let's go out to the observatory. So the McDonald Observatory is in Texas and it's affiliated with the University of Texas. And we drove like 8 hours out there and went backpacking. And then we drove to the observatory for a night and we looked at the stars and at planets through telescopes that were kind of strewn across the lawn. And it reminded me of why I'm doing this. And it reminded me that my final exam or my problem set, whatever it was that was stressing me out and making me feel like I wasn't good enough or I couldn't do this, didn't really matter, right? The reason I was doing it was because of that, me looking through a telescope at the stars and seeing that beauty and seeing, you know, that curiosity of, wow, how did that get there? What is that? What can I learn from that? So I guess I would just encourage people to remind themselves of why they're doing it. I think that's really important. I think it's really easy to get tunnel vision. Mm-hmm. And I think finding a community is the other big thing. So both of those things really helped me I'm sure there's like a million other things I could say, but those are two big things, I think.
No, that's excellent. Through Bunsen's account, I see your community having interactions, and it's just so inspiring. The kids will be standing on your shoulders when, you know, in years when you're done this. They'll be looking at you as their role model. And I know right now it's not too far-fetched to think of it that way. So I don't know. Your story is very, very inspiring. So, and that's a good point too, to really think about why you're doing what you're doing, right?
A lot of people, just one last thing. I think a lot of people, especially in college, they get so caught up in, you know, I have to take this class and I have to pass this final and then I'll end up with a degree, but I don't even know what that degree means. And I think, you know, as much as you can, just try to remember why you are studying what you're studying. No matter what it is, I think, you know, because it's the rest of it doesn't matter, right? The rest of it is kind of the periphery.
One of the things we end the podcast with, the Ask an Expert, is the super fact. And I'm pretty excited to hear your super fact, because every time I ask somebody who knows a little bit more about space than me, it's something that just blows my mind. Even, and I don't know that much about space. I'm a chemist, so I deal with little teeny tiny things you can't even see. So, would you be able to share a super fact with us about space that, if you were telling an average person, it would just like blow their mind and they just wouldn't be able to handle what you just told them?
Absolutely. Yeah, I could try.
Okay, I can't wait. I can't wait.
So I think my favorite fact, this has been my favorite fact about the universe and astronomy since I first took my astronomy class in 11th grade. And that is that we only know 4% of the entire universe through all of whatever humankind has studied and learned, and what we've interacted with and what we've looked up at in the sky is only 4% of the universe. And the rest of the 96% of the universe, we just have absolutely no idea what it is. And of course, that's an active field of study, but really remembering, like, wow, we are working on such a small scale compared to what's actually out there, is every time I think about that, it just blows my mind. So hopefully that blows somebody else's mind, but it really shocks me every single time.
Oh, I'm going to get in trouble if I don't ask you this question from my students.
Yeah.
Because when I started the podcast, I said, oh, I'm going to try and get somebody who knows something about space. And the kids were like, you got to ask this person this question. And the question is, do you think we are alone?
Absolutely not.
Yay!
Yeah, absolutely not.
Good. I'm so glad.
I passed.
Yes. They're going to be, most of the kids are going to be so happy you said that. It's just, I think one of the kids said, I would be so depressed to know that this is the only thing in all that blackness that is alive.
Me too. Me too. No, I think there's definitely something else, someone else out there.
I hope so. And I hope so. It gives me hope.
Me too.
Yeah. So we're at the end. I don't want to keep you any longer. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. What can people do to find you if you want people to find your social media stuff?
Yeah, that would be great. So my Twitter handle is StarStrickenSF, and my Instagram is SarahNovaFina. So feel free to add me if you want, and I would love to hear from you guys. And I'm so honored to be asked to be on this podcast. It was so much fun. Thank you.
You betcha. Yesterday, you were tweeting about black holes or something 2 days ago. That was cool.
Yesterday I was tweeting about galaxy mergers, was super cool. And the day before that was neutron stars. So yeah, there's a lot of fun space stuff out there.
Well, thank you so much again, and we'll talk later.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have an awesome day, and give Bunsen a huge hug for me.
I will, and you do the same with Comet.
I will. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Alright, guys, I've opened up the mailbag, and we're ready to read some questions. The first question comes from Alex Ortiz on Twitter. Hockey fans, if yes, which team?
You guys hockey fans?
Not really, no.
Surprisingly, as Canadian as we are, I'm not. I just cheer for who's ever a Canadian team that's in the playoffs.
When I was younger, I'd watch a lot of hockey. And the Edmonton Oilers, who Wayne Gretzky used to play for, Edmonton is only like an hour and a half drive from us, so he was a huge Canadian hero. I definitely cheered for the Oilers. But there's another team just south of us called the Calgary Flames, and there's a huge rivalry between the Edmonton Oilers and the Calgary Flames. The Edmonton Oilers wear blue, and the Calgary Flames wear red. Hockey is pretty exciting to go to a professional game, though. Like, it's a pretty exciting game. It's very fast. So in basketball, sometimes you're down to like the last minute and they do that fouling thing to try and get the free throws. And the last minute of basketball can drag on. Same thing. Other sports.
Football
sometimes. Baseball has like long periods where everybody's just standing around watching the pitcher pitch. But hockey is constant motion, which is pretty cool. It's exciting to go see.
I would like to give out a shout out to our Red Deer hockey team. It's WHL, the Red Deer Rebels.
All right, the next question comes from Ralph Williams on Twitter. Could you, like I, binge The Office every weekend? Do you agree that Jim and Pam are relationship goals? Who's secretly your favorite family member, Bunsen?
Bunsen, who's your favorite family member?
Mummy.
Okay. Do we love The Office?
Yeah, we do.
Oh my goodness, yeah. We watch The Office all the time. We're going to be so sad when it leaves Netflix. We watch it on and off. It's like we probably watch one episode at night. It's really the only thing we watch because we only have Netflix. Who's your favorite character?
I really like Jim.
I really like Robert California.
He's so creepy.
That's why I like him.
He's the Lizard King.
I like Michael Scott. I really do.
Yeah, Michael Scott's pretty cringy. But you know what? You know who I find that is an underrated character is the CFO, David Wallace.
Yeah, he truly is.
Yeah, he in every episode, he's the straight man to all of the craziness, and I really like that.
Wait, what about Creed Bratton?
Oh yeah, Creed's, you know, they're all so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to believe, but Michael Shore was one of the writers for it. Michael Shore is actually Dwight's cousin, Moe's. Dwight's cousin, Moe's. And that's Michael Shore. He wrote The Office. And he's got a new show, which I really like. I don't know if Adam and Chris have seen it all, but it's called The Good Place. It's so funny.
Yeah, I really like The Good Place, too. But what do you think, Jason? Do you think Jim and Pam are relationship goals?
I think it's pretty adorable. I like how Jim didn't give up and he kept picking away and he didn't stop trying to get Pam. So, but you need that in one of those. You need one of that in the sitcoms, the will they or won't they that type thing.
Yeah.
To create tension.
I think bigger relationship goals is Michael and Holly. I think when Michael and Holly get together, they're just perfect for each other.
Yeah, I do too.
All right.
What about Phyllis and Bob?
Oh yeah, Phyllis and Bob Vance. Vance Refrigeration. They're good too.
All right. The next question comes from Winnie Samoyed on Twitter. What is your favorite scientific discovery? Bunsen, why don't you tell us what your favorite scientific discovery is? All right. So Dad, what does that mean?
What Bunsen's favorite scientific discovery is?
Yeah.
Well, he's very pro-vaccination, so probably the vaccine that was started with, the polio vaccine by Jonas Salk. He was instrumental in getting the polio vaccine up and running. Vaccination's really important to my family because my grandmother suffered from polio. She got polio the year the polio vaccine became available worldwide, and she was hospitalized and she lost the ability to walk for the rest of her life, and then she suffered from post polio syndrome for till she died. We knew somebody affected that couldn't get vaccinated, so I would say the scientific discovery of vaccinations is really important to me
What about you guys? Do you have anything else?
I like the discovery of electricity because that turned into what it is now and how Bunsen can be wide streamed on the internets.
Who discovered electricity?
Tesla did.
No.
Mom?
Not Edison.
There's a bunch of people who discovered electricity, but probably the most important person was Michael Faraday.
Oh, Michael Faraday. I love him with his Faraday's cage.
Yeah, yeah.
I like his hair.
Yeah, he had okay hair. He was the one that figured out how to make electric generators. So how we produce power now comes from Faraday's invention. And that's the mailbag. Okay, time to close the mailbag, Adam.
All right, let me grab it. Oh, it's kind of heavy.
I know.
Time to close the mailbag.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Science Podcast this week. I hope you learned some new information, found out some cool stories about dogs. Special thanks to our guest, Serafina Nance, whose story was so exciting and inspiring. It makes me want to go out and look at the stars. To close, as always, remember Bunsen's motto. For science, for empathy, and cuteness.